building can be sealed off from the base outside, can become a fortress. What goes on here must be very, very important. All this time, Melanie is trying hard not to think about Marcia and Liam. She's scared about what might happen to her here. She's scared of never being able to go back to her friends, and the classroom, and Miss Justineau. Perhaps it's that fear, as much as the novelty, that makes her so acutely aware of her surroundings. She's registering everything she sees. She's also doing her best to memorise it all, especially the route they've taken. She wants to be able to find her way back, if she's free at any point to do that. The chemical spray dribbles and sputters to a stop. Sergeant wheels her forward, through a double swing door, along a corridor to another door, over which a bare red light bulb shines. A sign on the door reads, "No admittance to unauthorised personnel." Sergeant stops there, presses a buzzer, and waits. After a few seconds, the door is opened from the inside by Dr. Selkirk. She's in her usual white gown, but she's also wearing green plastic gloves, and around her throat there's a thing like a white cotton necklace. She raises this now with a tug of her index finger and thumb. It's a mask, made of white gauze, that fits over the lower part of her face. "Good morning, Dr. Selkirk," Melanie says. Dr. Selkirk looks at her for a moment as though she's deciding whether or not to answer. In the end, she just nods. Then she laughs. It's a hollow, unhappy sound, Melanie thinks. The laugh you'd make if you rubbed out a mistake in a sum you were doing and accidentally tore the paper. "Postman," Sergeant Parks says laconically, "where do you want this?" "Right," Dr. Selkirk says, her voice muffled by the mask. "Yes, you can bring her in. We're ready for her." She stands aside and pulls the door wide so Sergeant can wheel Melanie inside. This room is the strangest thing Melanie has ever seen. Of course, she's starting to realise that she hasn't seen all that much, but there are more things here of more baffling variety than she would have thought the whole world could hold. Bottles and tanks and jars and boxes, surfaces of white ceramic and stainless steel that gleam in the harsh radiance of strip lights overhead. Some of the things in the bottles look like parts of people. Some of them are animals. Closest to her is a rat. She recognises it from a picture in a book, suspended head down in clear liquid. Thin grey strings like shoelaces, hundreds of them, have exploded from the rat's body cavity and filled most of the interior space of the bottle, wrapped loosely around and around the little corpse, as though the rat had decided to try to be an octopus and then hadn't known how to stop. One bottle along from the rat is an eyeball, with gaudy streamers of nerve tissue attached behind. These things fill Melanie's mind with wild surmise. She says nothing, drinks it all in. "Transfer her to the table, please." It's not Dr. Selkirk who says this. It's Dr. Caldwell. She's standing at a work surface on the far side of the room, arranging shiny steel objects in a precise order. She touches some of them several times over, as though the distance and angles between them matter a great deal to her. "Good morning, Dr. Caldwell," Melanie says. "Good morning, Melanie," Dr. Caldwell says. "Welcome to my laboratory, the most important room on the base." With Dr. Selkirk's help, Sergeant transfers Melanie from her chair onto a high table in the centre of the room. It's a complex manoeuvre. They untie her hands from the armrests and handcuff them in front of her. They lock her feet to a restraint bar. Then they undo the neck strap and lift her onto the table. She weighs almost nothing, so they don't have any trouble carrying her. Once she's sitting on the table, they strap her feet into harnesses low down on its sides, which Dr. Selkirk adjusts carefully so that they're tight. Then they remove the restraint bar, which is no longer needed. "Lie down, Melanie," Dr. Caldwell says, "and hold out your hands." The women take one hand each, and as Sergeant unlocks the cuffs, they carefully set her wrists in two more harnesses. Dr. Caldwell ties them up. Melanie is completely immobile now, apart from her head. She's grateful that there's no neck strap like the one on the chair.
"You need me?"
Sergeant asks Dr. Caldwell. "Emphatically not." Sergeant wheels the chair back to the door. Melanie takes this in and reads it right. She won't be needing the chair again. She won't be going back to her cell. Tales the muses told is lying under her mattress back there, and she crashes headfirst into the realization that she may never see it again. Those pages that smell of Miss Justineau are now, and perhaps forever, inaccessibly distant. She wants to cry out to Sergeant to wait, or ask him to carry a message to Miss J. She can't say a word. Misgivings are crowding in on her. She's in uncharted territory, and she fears the blank, inscrutable future into which she's being rushed before she's ready. She wants her future to be like her past, but knows it won't be. The knowledge sits like a stone in her stomach. The door closes behind Sergeant. The two women begin to undress her. They use scissors, cutting her out of her cotton shift. Chapter 17. For Helen Justineau, the first hint that something is wrong is when she's walking down the corridor from the shower to the classroom. She looks for Melanie's face in the mesh window of her door, but Melanie doesn't appear. She unlocks the classroom and stands at her desk while the children are wheeled in one by one. She says hello to each in turn. The 20th child, the 21st until Marcia was taken, ought to be Melanie, but it's Anne. One of the deadpan soldier boys deposits her and immediately heads for the door. "Hold on," Justineau says. The private stops, turns back to face her with minimal civility.
"Yes, miss?"
"Where's Melanie?" He shrugs. "One of the cells was empty," he offers. "I went on to the next one. Is there a problem?" Justineau doesn't answer. She leaves the classroom, walks out into the corridor. She goes to Melanie's cell. Nothing to be seen there. The door of the cell stands open. The bed and the chair are both empty. Nothing about this feels right. The soldier is at her back, asking her again if there's a problem. She ignores him and heads for the stairs. Sergeant Parks is standing at the top, talking in a low voice to a group of three soldiers who all look very scared, very far from business as usual. At another time that might give Justineau pause. At another time she'd at least wait for him to finish, but she barges right in. "Sergeant," she says, "has Melanie been moved?" Parks has seen her walk up, but he stares at her now as though he's only just registered who she is.
"I'm sorry, Miss Justineau," he says. "We've got something of an emergency. Potentially. We're clocking large numbers of hungries close to the perimeter."
"Has Melanie been moved?" Justineau repeats. Sergeant Parks tries again. "If you go back to the classroom, we can talk about this as soon as..." "Just answer me. Where is she?" Parks glances away just for a second, then looks her square in the eyes. "Dr. Caldwell asked for her to be sent over to the lab." Justineau's stomach free falls.
"And you... you took her?" she asks stupidly.
He nods. "About half an hour ago. I would have told you, obviously, but class hadn't started, and I didn't know where you were."
"But she should have known as soon as she saw the empty cell. Once it's said, it becomes so blindingly obvious that she curses herself for wasting those few precious minutes. She's off at a run towards the lab complex. Parks is shouting at her, something about needing to get inside. But there'll be time for him later. If she's too late, all the time in the worthless fucking world." Chapter 18.
Dr. Caldwell and Dr. Selkirk wash Melanie all over her body, very thoroughly, with disinfectant soap that smells just like the spray from the showers. She submits to this in silence, her thoughts racing.
"Do you like learning about science, Melanie?"
Dr. Caldwell asks her. Dr. Selkirk shoots Dr. Caldwell a slightly startled look.
"Yes," Melanie says guardedly.
When she's clean, Dr. Caldwell picks up some sort of tool about the size of a blackboard rubber. She presses on it and it starts to hum in her hand. She puts it against the side of Melanie's head, draws it across her scalp in short, straight lines. It sends vibrations through her skin into her skull. Melanie is about to ask what this thing is, but then she sees Dr. Selkirk lift up a handful of blonde hair and drop it into a plastic bin. Dr. Caldwell is thorough, going over the whole of Melanie's head twice. The second time she presses harder and it actually hurts, just a little. Dr. Selkirk scoops away more drifts of Melanie's hair. Then she wipes her hands carefully with a wet paper towel taken from a dispenser on the wall. Dr. Caldwell applies bright blue paint to Melanie's scalp from a plastic jar labelled Bactericide Gel E2J. Melanie tries to imagine what she must look like now, bareheaded and blue. She must be a little bit like a Pictish warrior. Mr. Whittaker showed them some pictures of Picts, one time when his voice was blurry, and he couldn't stop laughing at the phrase pictures of Picts. If someone went into battle naked, the Picts said he was sky-clad. Melanie has almost never been naked. It's not a nice feeling at all, she decides. It makes her feel vulnerable and ashamed.
I don't, she says.
What? Dr. Caldwell sets down the brush and wipes her fingers against her white coat, leaving sky-blue streaks.
I don't like learning about science. I want to go back to the classroom, please.
Dr. Caldwell meets her gaze for the first time. I'm afraid that's not possible, she says. Close your eyes, Melanie.
No,
Melanie says. She's certain that if she does, Dr. Caldwell will do something mean to her. Something that will hurt. And suddenly, like seeing the other side of an optical illusion, she knows what that something will be. They're going to cut her up and put pieces of her in jars like these pieces of other people all around her. She throws her weight against the straps, struggles desperately, but they don't move at all.
Should we try some isoflurane?
Dr. Selkirk asks. Her voice is unsteady. She sounds like she might be going to cry. They don't respond, Dr. Caldwell says.
You know that. I refuse to waste one of our last few cylinders of general anaesthetic, making the experimental subject feel vaguely drowsy. Please remember, Doctor, that the subject presents as a child, but is actually a fungal colony animating a child's body. There's no place for sentiment here.
No, Dr. Selkirk agrees. I know. She picks up a knife, of a kind that Melanie has never seen before. It has a very long handle and a very short blade, the blade so thin that when it's edge onto her, it's almost invisible. She holds it out to Dr. Caldwell.
I want to go back to the classroom, Melanie says again.
The knife slips through Dr. Selkirk's fingers and falls to the floor just before Dr. Caldwell can take it. It makes a ringing sound as it hits, and again as it bounces.
I'm sorry,
Dr. Selkirk yelps. She bends to pick it up, hesitates, straightens again, and takes another from the instrument tray instead. She flinches from Dr. Caldwell's glare as she hands it over.
If the noise is troubling you, Dr. Caldwell says, I'll remove the pharynx first.
And she puts the cold edge of the blade against Melanie's throat.
It'll be the last fucking thing you ever do, says Miss Justineau's voice.
The two women pause in their work and look towards the door,
Melanie can't at first, because if she raises her head, she'll cut her own throat on the blade of the knife. But then Dr. Caldwell moves her hand away, and she's free to bend her neck and take a peek. Miss Justineau is standing in the doorway. She's holding something in her hands, a red cylinder with a black tube attached to one side of it. Seems to be pretty heavy. "Good morning, Miss Justineau," Melanie says. She's dizzy with relief, but the ridiculous, inadequate words are hardwired into her. She couldn't keep them in if she tried. "Helen," Dr. Caldwell says, "please come in, won't you? And close the door. This isn't exactly an antiseptic environment, but we're doing our best." "Put the scalpel down," Miss Justineau says. "Now." Dr. Caldwell frowns. "Don't be absurd. I'm in the middle of a dissection." Miss Justineau advances into the room, stopping only when she comes to the bottom end of the table where Melanie's bare feet are strapped down. "No," she says, "you're at the start of a dissection. If you were in the middle of it, we wouldn't be talking right now. Put the scalpel down, Caroline, and nobody gets hurt." "Oh dear," Dr. Caldwell says. "This isn't going to end well, is it?" "That's kind of up to you." Dr. Caldwell glances at Dr. Selkirk, who hasn't made a move or said a word since Miss Justineau came into the room. She's just standing there with her mouth half open, her hands clasped to her chest. She looks like someone who's staring at a hypnotist's watch and is about to go under. "Jean," Dr. Caldwell says, "call security, please, and tell them to come and remove Helen from the theatre." Dr. Selkirk glances at the phone on the work surface and takes a half step in that direction. Miss Justineau swings round a lot faster and brings the fire extinguisher down on the phone. The handset breaks in two with a dry, complicated crunching sound. Dr. Selkirk jumps back. "Yeah, look at it, Jean," Miss Justineau tells her. "The next time you move, you're getting this right in your face." "And you'll make the same threat if I try to go to the door, or the window, I suppose," Dr. Caldwell says. "Helen, I don't think you've thought this through. It really doesn't matter whether I call off this procedure or not. You can take Melanie out of the lab, but you can't take her out of the base. Every gate is guarded, and outside the gate there are perimeter patrols. There is no way you can stop this." Miss Justineau doesn't answer, but Melanie knows that Dr. Caldwell is wrong. Miss Justineau can do anything she wants to do. She's like Prometheus, and Dr. Caldwell is like Zeus. Zeus thought he was big and clever because he was a god, but the Titans weren't scared of him at all. Of course, in the story, the Titans lost in the end, but Melanie is in no doubt about who's going to win this battle. "I'll take it one step at a time," Miss Justineau growls. "Jean, undo those straps." "Don't," Dr. Caldwell says quickly, "do anything of the kind." She gives Dr. Selkirk a brief, fierce stare as she says this, then turns her full attention back to Miss Justineau. And softens on the instant. "Helen, you're not well. The situation here has put all of us under terrible strain, and this fantasy of rescuing the test subject, well, it's all part of your response to that stress. We're all friends and colleagues. Nobody is going to be reported. Nobody is going to be punished. We're going to work this out, because really there isn't any alternative." Miss Justineau hesitates, lulled by this gentleness. "I'm going to put the scalpel down," Dr. Caldwell says. "I'm asking you to do the same with your weapon." And Dr. Caldwell does what she promised. She shows the scalpel, holds it high for a second, then sets it down on the edge of the table close to Melanie's left side. She does this slowly, with exaggerated care. So Miss Justineau is watching the hand with the scalpel. Of course she is. With the other hand, Dr. Caldwell takes something small and shiny from the pocket of her lab coat.
Miss Justineau!
Melanie shrieks. Too late. Much too late. Dr. Caldwell thrusts the shiny something into Miss Justineau's face. There's a sound like the hiss of the shower spray, and a smell on the air that's sour and scalding and takes your breath away. Miss Justineau gurgles, the sound cut off very suddenly. She drops the fire extinguisher and she's clawing at her face. She sinks slowly to her knees, then topples sideways onto the floor of the lab, where she twitches and writhes, making noises like she's choking. Dr. Caldwell stares at her dispassionately. Now, go and get a security detail, she says to Dr. Selkirk. I want this woman under military arrest. The charge will be attempted sabotage. Melanie slumps back onto the table with a moan of anguish, both for herself and for Miss Justineau. Despair fills her, makes her as heavy as lead. Dr. Selkirk heads for the door, but that means she has to skirt around Miss Justineau, who is still on her knees, wheezing and moaning as she tries to draw a breath through the burning miasma of whatever it was that Dr. Caldwell hit her with. It's heavy in the air, and Dr. Selkirk starts coughing too. Entirely out of patience, Dr. Caldwell reaches out her hand to pick up the scalpel again. But right then, something happens that makes her stop. Two things, really. The first is an explosion, loud enough to make the windows rattle in their frames. The second is an ear-splitting scream, like 100 people shrieking all at the same time. Dr. Selkirk's face looks first blank, then terrified. That's general evacuation, she says. Isn't it? Isn't that the evacuation siren? Dr. Caldwell doesn't waste time answering her. She crosses to the window and hauls up the blinds. Melanie sits up again, as far as she can, but she's too low down. Mostly what she can see is the sky outside. Both the doctors are staring out of the window. Miss Justineau is still on the floor, her hands clasped to her face, her back and shoulders shaking. She's oblivious to everything except her pain.
What's happening? Dr. Selkirk bleats. There are people moving out there. Are they...
I don't know, Dr. Caldwell snaps. I'm going to lower the emergency shutters. We can hold out here until the all clear sounds. She reaches out to do it. She puts her hand on the switch. That's when the window shatters. And the Hungries swarm over the sill. Chapter 19. Long before Sergeant Parks has come up with any kind of a counterattack, the fences are down. It's not that it happens fast, it's just remorseless. The Hungries that Gallagher clocked in the trees on the eastern perimeter suddenly come out of there at a flat run. They're not hunting anything, they're just running. And the strangeness of that maybe makes Parks hesitate for a second or two while he tries to figure it out. Then the wind changes and the smell hits him. A rank wave of decomposition, so intense it's almost like a punch in the face. Soldiers on either side of him gasp. Someone swears. And the smell tells him, even before he sees it. There are more of them. A lot more. That's the smell of a whole herd of Hungries, a frigging tidal wave of Hungries. Too many to stop. So the only option is to slow them down. Blunt that headlong charge before they reach the fence. Aim for the legs, he shouts. Full auto! And then, fire! The soldiers do as they're told. The air fills with the angry punctuation of their guns. Hungries fall and are trampled under by more Hungries coming behind them. But there are too many and they're too close. It's not going to stop them. Then Park sees something else at the back of the moving wall of undead. Junkers. junkers so thickly padded with body armour that each of them looks like the Michelin Man. Some are carrying spears. Others are wielding what look like cattle prods, which they jam into the neck or back of any hungry who slows down. At least two are holding flamethrowers. Jets of flame fired to right and left hem in the hungries and keep them from straying too far off the target, which is the fence and the base beyond. Two bulldozers are also rolling along on the flanks of the herd, their blades set obliquely. When the hungries straggling at the edges get too close, they either turn back towards the central mass or else they're ploughed under. This isn't a stampede. It's a cattle drive. "Oh, God," says Private Allsop in a strangled voice. "Oh, Jesus!" Parks wastes another moment in marvelling at the sheer genius of the assault, using the hungries as battering rams, as weapons of war. He wonders how the junkers rounded up so many, and where they corralled them before this forced march. But that's just logistics. The idea of doing something like this, it's nothing short of majestic. "Target the live ones," he bellows. "The junkers! Fire on the junkers!" But they only get in a couple of ragged volleys before he yells at them to fall back, to get away from the fence. Because the fence is going to give, and they're going to be neck deep in rotting cannibals. They retreat in good order, firing as they go. The wave hits. It doesn't even slow. Hungries slam full tilt into the mesh and into the concrete stanchions that support it. It leans inwards, groans and creaks, but seems to be holding. The front rank of walking corpses are treading water. But more and more hungries fetch up behind them, push against them, transmit their own weight and momentum to the point of impact, the flimsy barricade of woven wire links. The concrete posts themselves are starting to list drunkenly. A stretch of fence goes down, suddenly unviable, as a fence post tilts clean out of the ground, along with a hemispheric divot of earth. Dozens of the don't-know-they're-dead come down with it, trampled and ground down and compressed to mincemeat. But there are plenty more where they came from. They rush forward, their pistoning feet threshing the remains of the fallen. As quick as that, the hungries are through. Chapter 20. Justinu tries to stand. It's not easy because her guts are churning, her lungs are full of acid, and the floor under her feet heaves like the deck of a ship. Her face feels like a mask of white-hot iron, fitted way too tight over her skull. Things are moving around her, quickly, with no accompanying narrative apart from panting breath and a single muffled shriek. She's been blind since Caldwell sprayed her, and although the initial rush of tears washed most of the pepper spray out of her eyes, they're still swollen half shut. She sees blurred shapes, crashing against each other like flotsam in the wake of a flood. She blinks furiously, trying to dredge up some more moisture from her now dry-baked tear ducts. Two of the shapes resolve. One is Selkirk, on her side on the floor of the lab, her legs jackknifing in furious staccato. The other is a hungry which is kneeling astride her, stuffing her spilled intestines into his mouth in pink, sagging coils. More hungries surge in from all sides, hiding Selkirk from view. She's a honeypot for putrescent bees. The last Justinu sees of her is her inconsolable face.
"Melanie," Justinu thinks. "Where's Melanie?"
The room is a sea of scrambling, clutching bodies. Justinu backs away from the feeding frenzy, almost backs into another. By the window of the room, Caroline Caldwell is fighting for her life with silent ferocity. Two hungries who came over the sill, crawling on hands and knees, leaving pieces of themselves on the jagged edges of the broken glass, have gripped her legs and are swarming up her body. Their jaws are working like the interlocking scoops of mechanical diggers. Caldwell has got her hands on the tops of their heads, as though in benediction. But what she's actually doing is pushing against them as hard as she can, trying desperately to stop them from bending forward and sinking their teeth into her. She's losing that battle, inch by inch. Justinu finds the fire extinguisher where she dropped it, its bright red paint calling out to her across the lab's anodyne whites and greys. She picks it up, turns like a hammer thrower and swings it underarm. It makes contact with a hollow clang, and the head of one of the Hungries sags sideways, the neck snapped cleanly. It still doesn't let go, but Caldwell's right hand is freed because the thing's jaws can't be brought to bear now that its neck is no longer pulling its weight. With the strength and resolution of sheer terror, Caldwell uses her free hand to grip a slender triangle of glass that's still adhering to the window frame and pulls it loose. Her own blood wells up between her fingers as she slashes at the other Hungry again and again, flaying its face off its skull in broad strips. Justinu leaves her to it. With the window right in front of her, she can orientate herself. She turns to face the operating table. Amazingly, her line of sight is clear. Most of the Hungries are fighting over scraps of Jean Selkirk, which means they're down on hands and knees, snouts in the trough. The operating table is empty. The plasticated straps that had held Melanie immobile now hang useless, sheared clean through. The scalpel that Caldwell put down before she used the pepper spray is lying discarded at the head end of the table. Justinu looks around wildly. She makes a sound like a moan, which is lost in the liquid, snuffling sounds of the monster's banquet. The chaos of the room has resolved itself into simplicity. Selkirk hosting the feast. Caldwell carving at the face and upper body of the Hungry that's still blindly trying to ascend her, until it finally falls away. Effectively peeled. Melanie is nowhere. Caldwell is free now, and she's frantically gathering up notes and samples with her blood-slicked hands, trying to pile up too many things in her arms until they fall to the floor in a clattering cascade. The sound is loud enough to rouse the Hungries who are eating Selkirk. Their heads jerk up and turn, left and then right, in eerie synchrony. Caldwell is down on one knee, picking up the fallen treasures. Justinu grips her by the collar and hauls her upright. "Come on!" she shouts. Or she tries to shout. But she's swallowed some of the pepper spray, so her tongue is three times its normal size. She sounds like Charles Lawton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Doesn't matter. She's hauling Caldwell to the door like a mother dragging a willful child, as the Hungries surge up from the floor and trample over what's left of Dr. Selkirk in their eagerness to reach this new food source. Justinu slams the lab door in their faces. It's not locked, but that's a detail. Hungries are no better with locks than wild dogs would be. The door shudders from their repeated assaults, but it doesn't open. The women are in a short corridor, with the shower unit at the other end of it. Justinu is heading for the shower and the doors beyond, which she left wide open when she came in. But she slows and stops before she gets there. In the space between this block and the vehicle sheds, a running firefight is going on. The men she can see ducking and shooting and taking cover behind the angle of the next building are not Sergeant Parks's men, in the khaki she always hated. They're savages, in motley, their hair blacked and sculpted with tar, machetes tucked into their belts. Junkers. While Justinu is still staring, two of the men leap into the air, backflipping at impossible speed. The flash and roar of the grenade comes half a second later, and the peristaltic shudder of the shockwave a heartbeat after that. Caldwell points to another door. Maybe she says something too, but the wild carillon in Justinu's ears blots out all other sounds. The door is locked. Caldwell rummages in her pockets, leaving dark red Bézier curves of blood on her white lab coat. Her hands, Justinu sees, are in a really bad state. flaps of skin hanging loose from deep incisions where she gripped the jagged glass sliver to hit out with it. Pocket after pocket. Caldwell can't find the key. She tears open the coat at last, tries her trouser pockets, and it's there. She gets the door open, and they're in what turns out to be a storeroom, filled with a dozen or more identical grey steel shelf units. It's a refuge. It's a trap. As soon as Caldwell locks the door from the inside, Justineau realises she can't stay here. Melanie is wandering around somewhere outside, like Red Riding Hood in the deep, dark woods, surrounded by men who are firing automatic weapons. Justineau has to find her, which means she has to get outside. Caldwell leans against the end of a shelf unit, either pulling herself together or retreating into some inner space that's nicer than this one. Justineau ignores her, checks out the narrow room. There are no other doors, but there's a window, high up on the wall. It will open onto the side of the building that's closest to the perimeter fence and furthest from the fighting. From there, she could maybe make a run for it, back to the classroom block, where Melanie will have gone to ground, if she was able to find her way back there. Justineau starts to empty the nearest shelf unit, sweeping boxes and bottles, bags of surgical gauze, rolls of paper towel off the shelves onto the floor. Caldwell watches her in silence as she pulls the unit over to the window where it can serve as a ladder. "They'll kill you," Caldwell says.
They're here,"
Justineau snarls over her shoulder. But when she starts to climb, Caldwell steadies the unit with her shredded hands, then clambers up after her, emitting a little gasp of pain every time she has to grip the cold metal of the unit. The window secures with a catch. Justineau releases it and tilts it open an inch. Outside, just a stretch of untrodden grass. The shouts and gunshots are deadened by distance. She pushes the window fully open and climbs through, dropping down onto the grass. It's still wet with morning dew, cold against her ankles. The ordinariness of that feeling is like a telegram from the other side of the world. Caldwell has more trouble getting out because she's trying not to use her injured hands to support her weight. She falls heavily, unable to keep her balance, and sprawls full length in the grass. Justineau helps her up, none too gently. From the corner they can see right across the parade ground to the classroom block and the barracks proper. There are hungries everywhere, in tight groups and running hard. Justineau thinks they're running at random, but then she sees the Junker herders in their weird armour, driving them on with spear points, tasers, and good old-fashioned fire. Clinically, she notes that the Junkers are all plastered with tar, not just their hair, but the flesh of their arms and hands, the weave of their Kevlar vests. It must do something similar to what the E-blocker spray does, masking the smell of their endocrine sweat so that the hungries don't turn and swim up that chemical gradient all the way to their tormentors' throats. But mostly she thinks, hungries as bioweapons. Win or lose, the base is done for. "I'm going to try to get across to the classroom block," she tells Caldwell. "You should probably give it a few seconds, then head for the fence. At least some of them will be looking the other way." "The classroom block is underground," Caldwell snaps. "There's only one way in or out. You'll be trapped." What a wonderful pair of scientists the two of them are. Assembling known facts into valid inferences. Forensic minds refusing to quit in the face of this utter fucking nightmare. Justineau doesn't bother to answer. She just runs. She's plotted a course and she sticks to it, giving the nearest pack of hungries a wide berth as they sweep on past her, heading for the barracks. The Junkers who are herding them are too busy with what they're doing to turn aside for her. And their comrades, coming up behind them, are taking fire from both sides. Parks's people are using the terrain, turning the open spaces between the wooden huts into killing grounds. Justinu has to swerve away from three soldiers who are running right towards her, rifles in their hands, and then she's sideways onto another stampeding wedge of Hungries. She tacks and weaves, and only realizes she's lost her way when she rounds another corner. And what's in front of her is about a dozen spike-haired men, their limbs black and shiny with tar that must still be liquid, firing from behind a makeshift barricade of overturned dumpsters. The junkers turn and see her. Most of them turn right back again and keep on firing, but two immediately stand and walk towards her. One pulls a knife from a sheath at his belt and hefts it in his hand. The other just levels the gun he's already carrying. Justinu freezes. No point in running, turning her back to the gun, and when she tries to come up with another response, her brain floods with a cold flush of nothing at all. The knife man kicks her legs out from under her, sends her sprawling. He grips the sleeve of her shirt, hauls her half upright, and holds her out to the other as though he's offering her up as a gift. "Do it," he says. Justinu raises her head. Usually a bad idea to make eye contact with a wild animal, but if she's going to die anyway, she wants to die telling him to go screw himself and, if she has time, exactly how and where. It's the gunner whose gaze she meets, and she realizes with an almost surreal jolt of surprise how young he is, still in his teens, probably. He moves the gun from her head to point it at her chest, maybe because he doesn't want to go home from this with the image of her exploded face hanging in the gallery of his dreams. There's something ritualistic about all this, the way the older man holds her still and waits for the other to dispatch her. It's a rite of passage, a bonding moment, maybe, between a father and a son. The youngster steels himself visibly. Then he's gone. Knocked off his feet. Something dark and subliminally fast has whipped by and taken him with it. He writhes on the asphalt, struggling with an enemy that, despite its tiny size, spits and mews and claws at him like an entire sackful of pissed-off cats. It's Melanie, and she's not taking any prisoners. The man, boy, rather, gives a scream that tails off into a liquid gurgle as her jaws close on his throat. Chapter 21. The shock of that first taste of blood and warm flesh is so intense that it almost makes Melanie faint. Nothing in her life has ever been this good, not even having her hair stroked by Miss Justinu. The rush of pleasure is bigger than she is. The part of her that can think bends in that cataract, broadsided, and clings to whatever it can to keep from being swept away. She tries to remind herself what's at stake. She attacked the man because he was going to hurt Miss Justinu, not because of the irresistible fresh meat smell. She didn't catch a whiff of that until she was astride him, and she bit down before she'd even thought about doing it. Her body didn't need her permission for this, and it wasn't prepared to wait. Now she bites, and tears, and chews, and swallows, the sensations filling her and battering her like the torrent of a waterfall pouring into a cup held right under it. Something hits her hard, dislodging her from her prey, from her meal. Another man stands over her, leans down towards her, a knife raised in his hand. Miss Justinu tackles him from behind, her hands beating at his head. He has to turn to defend himself, and Melanie is able to get a solid grip on his leg. She wraps herself around him, lifts herself effortlessly off the ground with her strong arms, locks to him like a limpet. The man bellows incoherent curses and hammers at her frantically. The blows hurt, but they don't matter. Melanie finds the point where leg joins body, driven by some instinct so deep she can't even tell where it comes from. She fastens her teeth onto the man and bites through the leg of his pants until the blood wells thick and spurting into her mouth. She knew it would.
She sensed the arteries singing to her through the folds of flesh and fabric. The man's scream is a scary sound, shrill and wobbly. Melanie doesn't like it at all. But oh, she likes the taste. Likes the way his open thigh becomes a fountain, as though raw meat was a magic garden, a hidden landscape that she never glimpsed until now. It's too much, finally. Her stomach and her mind aren't big enough. The whole world isn't big enough. Numbed with delight, with repletion that melts her muscles and her thoughts, she doesn't resist this time when hands pluck her loose and lift her up. From under the reek of chemicals comes the Miss Justineau smell, familiar and welcome and wonderful. Pressed to Miss Justineau's chest, she emits a satiated purr. She wants to curl to sleep there, like an animal in its burrow. But she can't sleep, because Miss Justineau is moving, running fast. Each footfall jars Melanie. And the full feeling doesn't last. Her torpid hunger rallies quickly, prods at the edges of her mind with eager intimations. Already the smell means something different, is urging her to feed again. She turns and wriggles in a grip too weak to contain her, butts with her head against the underside of Miss J's arm, mouth open to bite again. But she can't. She mustn't. She can't. This is Miss Justineau, who loves her, who saved her from the table and the thin, scary knife. Melanie can't stop her jaws from closing, but she jerks her head back at the last moment so they close on air instead of flesh. A growl wells up from inside her, from the same place that mewled like a kitten only a few moments ago. Has to. Mustn't. Has to. She wrestles with a wild animal, and the animal is her. So she knows she's going to lose. Chapter 22. Justineau is running again, but now she has no idea where she's running to. The familiar geography of the base has been rendered arcane by the smoke of explosions, the din of gunfire and running feet. Melanie makes it even harder to focus, squirming and thrashing in her grip. Justineau remembers lifting her from the body of the young Junker boy, like plucking a blood-gorged tick from a dog's belly, and has to fight the urge to drop her. Why fight it? Not because Melanie saved her, but then, in a sense, yes. Because she's turned her back on something inside herself, and Melanie is the sign of that. The anti-Isaac she snatched from the fire to prove to God that he doesn't always get to call the shots. Fuck you, Caroline. Melanie is making noises a human throat isn't properly configured for, and her head is levering backwards and forwards, butting at Justineau's arm. There's astonishing strength in the little girl. She's going to break free. She's going to bring the both of them down. Justineau glimpses the steel door of the classroom block, unexpectedly close by, and swerves towards it. Realises immediately that it's no use to her. The door is closed, and the locks engage automatically when it's in that position. There's no possible way she can get inside. Hungries loom on her right, a dozen or so, coming from the direction of the lab. Maybe they're the same ones she originally fled from, still following her scent. Either way, they can smell her now and they want her. They're coming towards her, legs rising and falling in tireless mechanical syncopation. Nothing for it but to turn tail, to run away from them as fast as she can and pray that she gets somewhere before they catch her. She does. She gets to the fence. It's suddenly right there in front of her, blocking her way like a wire mesh Everest. She's finished. She turns at bay. The Hungries are coming on at that same merciless metronomic sprint. To right and left there's nothing. Nowhere to hide or to run to. She lets go of Melanie, sees her fall like a cat falls, righting herself in the air to land on starfish-spread hands and feet. Justinu balls her fists, braces herself, but an enormous exhaustion hits her, and darkness rushes in from the corners of her vision as the adrenaline wave deserts her. She doesn't even throw a punch as the first hungry gapes its jaws and reaches out to pull her down. With a wet crunch, he slammed to the ground and ploughed under. A wall slides smoothly across Justinu's field of vision. It's metallic, painted in dull green, and there's a window in it. From the window, a monster's face stares out at her. Sergeant Parks's face. "Get inside!" he bellows. The thing in front of her resolves itself, like a puzzle picture. It's one of the base's Humvees. Justinu grabs the door handle and tries all the wrong ways to make it open, twisting and pulling before she finally pops it with a single squeeze of the catch release on the handle's inner face. She throws the door open as the Hungries round the back of the vehicle and start towards her. One of Parks's boy soldiers, a kid half her age with a mass of red hair like an autumn bonfire, is up on the roof, manning the Humvee's pedestal gun. He swings it wildly, stitching the air with stinging metal. It's not clear what he's aiming at, but on one of the downswings he intersects the nearest Hungries and knocks them right off their feet. Justinu holds the door but doesn't move, because Melanie doesn't move. Crouched on the ground, the little girl stares into the vehicle's dark interior with animal mistrust. "It's fine," Justinu yells. "Melanie, come on! Get inside, now!" Melanie makes up her mind, makes a standing jump past Justinu and in through the door. Justinu clambers in after her, slams the door tight shut. Turns to see Caroline Cordwell's pale, sweating face staring right at her. Her hands are folded under her armpits, and she's lying on the floor of the Humvee like a bolt of firewood. Melanie cowers away from her, presses against Justinu again, and mechanically, Justinu embraces her. The Humvee wheels around. Through the window they can briefly see a kaleidoscope of smoke and ruin and running figures. They drive through the fence without slowing, but almost don't make it across the ditch beyond. The Humvee belly flops on the far side, shudders for a few seconds like a washing machine on spin, before it gets enough traction to drag its rear end up over the rim. For the next few miles, it's chased by 5 yards of chain link and a concrete post, bounding along behind it the way a wedding car trails tin cans. Chapter 23. Parks would prefer to drive straight across country. The Humvee doesn't need roads all that much, but the scrape and grind from behind him tells him that all isn't well with the rear axle. So he shifts down to get a bit more push out of the engine, floors the gas, and drives with reckless speed down the empty B roads around the base, swerving left and right at random. He figures that the best way for them not to be found is, for the time being, to be lost themselves. At least there's no pursuit that he can see. That's something to be profoundly grateful for. He finally brings the Humvee to a halt about 10 miles from the base, pulling off the road onto a rutted, overgrown field. He turns off the ignition and gets his breath back, leaning over the wheel as the engine cools. The sounds it's making are not happy sounds. He grabbed the vehicle from the workshop, the only place he could get to without crossing a parade ground full of Hungries, and he wonders, now that it's too late, what it was in there for. Gallagher climbs down from the pedestal, folds the gun down after him and locks the hatch. He's shaking like he's got a fever, so these simple actions take him quite a while. When he's finally sitting in the shotgun seat, he gives the sergeant a terrified stare, looking for orders or explanations or anything that will help him to keep it together. "Good work," Parks tells him. "Check on the civilians. I'm going to do a quick recce." He opens the door, but he doesn't get any further than that. Glancing over into the back seat, Gallagher gives a short, pained yell. "Sarge? Sergeant Parks?"
"What is it, son?"
Parks asks wearily. He turns to look into the back with a sinking feeling, expecting to see that one of the two women has sustained a gut wound or something similar, that they're going to have to watch her die. But it's not that. Dr. Caldwell's coat is saturated with blood, but most of it seems to be from her hands, and Helen Justineau looks pretty much fine, apart from her red, puffed-up face. No. What made the boy shout out is their third passenger. It's one of the little hungry kids, the monsters from the containment block. Parks recognises her with a palpable shock as the one he just took over to the meat market, to Dr. Caldwell's lab. She's changed since then. She's crouching on the floor of the Humvee, buck naked, shaved bald, and painted like a savage, her vivid blue eyes flicking backwards and forwards between the women. The curve of her back speaks both tension and the imminence of movement. Awkwardly, because of the angle, Parks grabs his sidearm and takes aim, thrusting it between the seat backs so that it points directly at the little girl's head. A headshot is his best chance of putting her down at this sort of range. Their eyes meet. She doesn't move, like she's asking him to do it. It's Helen Justineau who stops him, interposing her body between them. In the narrow confines of the Humvee, she makes a pretty unanswerable barricade. "Move aside," Parks tells her. "Then put the gun down," Justineau says. "You're not killing her." "She's already dead," Dr. Caldwell points out from the floor, her voice uneven. "Technically speaking." Justineau shoots a sidelong glance at the doctor but doesn't bother to answer her. Her gaze comes back immediately to Parks. "She's not a danger," she says. "Not right now. You can see that. Let her get out of the car. Let her get some distance from you, from all of us. And take it from there. Okay?" What Parks can see is that the nightmare that walks like a girl is wide-eyed and trembling, barely in control of itself. Everyone in the car is chemmed up, E-blocker from hairline to socks, but there's enough blood kicking around, on Caldwell's hands and arms and clothes, on the kid herself, to be pushing her triggers anyway. He's never seen a hungry in a meat frenzy and not acting on it. It's a novelty. But he's not going to bet his life on it being a long-term trend. He either shoots her now, or he does what Justineau says. And if he shoots her, he takes the risk of killing one or both of the civilians. "Do it," he says. "Quickly." Justineau throws the door open. "Melanie," she says. The kid doesn't need to be told. She's out of there like a bullet, running away from the Humvee and across the field, her spindly legs a blur. She goes upwind. Parks can't help but notice. She gets away from the smell of them, from the smell of the blood. Then she crouches down in the long grass, almost lost to view, and hugs her knees. She turns her face away. "Good enough?" Justineau demands. "No," Caldwell says quickly. "She's got to be restrained and brought with us. We have no idea what happened to the rest of the subjects. If the base is lost, and my records along with it, she's all we've got to show for a 4-year programme." "Which says a lot for your programme," Justineau says. Caldwell glares. The air between them is thick with bad vibes. Parks gestures to Gallagher, a jerk of the head, and gets out of the vehicle, leaving the womenfolk to it. He's worried about the Humvee's rear axle, and he wants to take a look at it right away. No telling when they might have to move again. Chapter 24. Melanie is coming down. At first, she can't think at all. Then, when thoughts come back, she shrinks away from them, like Mr. Whittaker when his bottle is almost empty. Her mouth is haunted by memories that want to be real again. Her mind is reeling from what she's done. And her body is racked with a million ticks and shakes, each cell reporting in unfit for duty, demanding what it can't have. Almost empty. Her mouth is haunted by memories that want to be real again. Her mind is reeling from what she's done. And her body is racked with a million ticks and shakes, each cell reporting in unfit for duty, demanding what it can't have.